From ABC News, this is Perspective, this week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, major Supreme Court rulings on free speech and college athletics.
It signaled that if there are more challenges to the NCAA's way of doing business, that those challenges are likely to be successful. And that signal was sent to every lower court in the land.
A full capacity concert in New York City as the Delta variant of the coronavirus continues spreading across the country.
The woman next to me has a mask on. Everybody's starting to sing along. She just pulls that mask off and starts singing to the heavens. And I'm like, okay, what COVID?
And is inflation a looming threat or not?
There's just no way lumber or, you know, a piece of plywood can continue to increase. Projects ultimately will have to stop.
All ahead on Perspective. The Supreme Court is getting ready to go on summer break, which means it's time for all the decisions on cases that they've heard this term to be released. Last week, there was a major ruling keeping Obamacare in place, the justices overwhelmingly upholding the Affordable Care Act, ensuring that millions of Americans will be able to keep their health care. This week, the justices weighed in on a couple of cases involving how much control colleges and high schools can have over their students. The first case involved the free speech of a freshman from Pennsylvania who thought she should have made the varsity cheerleading squad. And she said so on Snapchat, using slightly more colorful language. Here's ABC's Aaron Katursky.
When then 14-year-old Brandi Levy failed to make the varsity cheerleading squad at Mahanoy Area High School in Pennsylvania, she vented her frustration on Snapchat, dropping a whole bunch of F-bombs into a snap.
I was angry, and I made a post on Snap. It was F school, F cheer, F softball, F everything.
The school accused her of breaching its code of conduct and suspended her from the junior varsity squad for a year.
They told me that I'm lucky I didn't get expelled from school for it because it was vulgar language.
It stunned her father, Larry.
If they would have just took her and said to her, Brandi, you know, kind of watch, just be careful what you're saying or you're doing. But as far as the action they took, I think that was far reached. Above and beyond where they should be.
The Supreme Court agreed. In an 8-1 opinion written by Justice Breyer, the court ruled the school's disciplinary action violated the First Amendment, as argued on Levy's behalf by the ACLU's Sarah Rose.
When they're not under their school supervision, kids are under their parents' supervision, and the parents are the ones who should be able to decide what's appropriate for their children to say when they're at home.
But that is not the end of the story. While a lower court had said schools have no authority over any student speech that occurs outside of school, the Supreme Court disagreed. Justice Breyer wrote, "We do not believe the special characteristics that give schools additional license to regulate student speech always disappear when that speech takes place off campus." And in that part of the opinion, Michael Levin, who represented the school district, found what he called a major victory.
It makes clear that school districts have the power and authority, and it's not restricted by the First Amendment to control certain conduct outside of school. That's exactly what we were arguing.
The court declined to say exactly when it might be okay for a school to regulate off-campus speech, but it mentioned instances of bullying, cheating, or threats.
The school district won the important issues of being able, in the appropriate circumstances, to control student expression where it meets the standards that the Supreme Court articulated.
In this case, the U.S. Supreme Court decided Brandi Levy's snap did not involve features that would place it outside the First Amendment's ordinary protection.
This is the most significant decision for young people's free speech rights in the past 50 years.
The ACLU's Sarah Rose hailed the ruling.
The court recognized that young people do have free speech rights and that they have to be protected. And while there were certain situations where maybe schools may have some leeway to punish kids for what they say outside of school, the court made it pretty clear that those are going to be very limited situations and that schools should proceed with caution before they extend their authority over student speech to outside of school.
Brandi Levy is now an 18-year-old college student, and she told us she celebrated the outcome with a pizza party.
Most of the messages is just like people congratulating me that like I stuck up for like what happened.
Reporting for Perspective, I'm Aaron Katursky, ABC News, New York.
The Supreme Court also upheld a lower court ruling, unanimously deciding that the cap on a relatively narrow list of education-related benefits for college athletes must be lifted. ABC's Devin Dwyer explains.
This case is significant in that it's a sign that the dam has broken a little bit, at least legally, when it comes to compensation to college athletes who long have complained that even coaches, commissioners of leagues have been making millions of dollars. Meanwhile, they have been limited only to their tuition, room and board, and a very limited $5,000 cap on things like computers, paid internships, study abroad, musical instruments. The Supreme Court said that cap on those education-related expenses violated antitrust laws.
It's a decision that will have major implications for the NCAA and college athletes. ESPN college basketball analyst Jay Billis, himself who played at Duke, was an assistant coach and is also a lawyer, has spoken out for a long time against the NCAA's practices. He talked about it this week with ABC's Eric Mallow.
It seems like this has been a long time coming, but it seems like we're only on the cusp of what this potentially could be for college athletes. Can you explain how it impacts athletes in the NCAA?
I think it's the biggest court ruling, certainly, and the biggest development since the Oklahoma Board of Regents case in 1984, the last time that the Supreme Court called the NCAA an antitrust violator. But that was when the schools sued the NCAA so that they could be on television when they wanted. That's when the money really exploded in college sports, even more than it was before, but the athlete remained the same. So while it's been discussed for over 100 years, whether amateurism was fair, the courts seemingly had blessed it through that Board of Regents case. And this Alston case, again, the highest court in the land ruled that the NCAA was an antitrust violator, but this time it was over players.
Did it feel like the NCAA got cornered here? You could run through the excuses that the NCAA has made through the years, but then ultimately you get to the Supreme Court, and yes, it's a narrow ruling, but it's overwhelmingly ruled in favor of the athlete and against the NCAA.
The real screw up by the NCAA here was appealing this case and taking it to the Supreme Court, because the lower court ruling in the Ninth Circuit was very good for the NCAA. It wasn't perfect. It said that, hey, you may have to give laptops and all that stuff if you want to. They could prohibit pay to players, and they could prohibit name, image, and likeness pay to players. But that wasn't good enough. I mean, that was about as stunning a rebuke as you can get from nine people wearing robes. And it signaled that if there are more challenges, that those challenges are likely to be successful. And that signal was sent to every lower court in the land.
Is it just gaining significance because of the amount of income? Or was there always been a feeling from a player that, you know, I deserve to be making some of this money beyond the scholarship argument?
The argument that athletes get scholarships, therefore they're compensated, is an irrationalization and nothing more, because more non-athlete students get scholarships than athletes. And it's not referred to as pay, and they're not limited in what they can earn or accept. When I was a player, did I think it was unfair that we as players were limited to a scholarship only and we couldn't take a free meal from someone or do a commercial or do anything we were asked to do? Did I think that was unfair? Damn right I did. We seem to operate a mindset, this multi-billion dollar enterprise teeters upon the athlete remaining unpaid. I don't believe that's true. I don't know any reasonable economist that believes that's true. And no one has stood up in court under oath and said that's true.
I wonder if one of the fears may be losing leverage over certain populations that they feel they have such control over. Does it go along racial lines as well?
Well, it's pretty clear it does go along racial lines. Now, whether the motivation is to maintain control over certain segments of the population, I can't speak to that. I don't have any information that would suggest that. What I do know is they want control over green, which is every dollar. You know, the NCAA and the member institutions look at pay to players as a zero-sum game. No other student is told what they can earn or accept in the marketplace while they're in school. Only an athlete is. And oddly enough, those athletes are being sold while they're being told that.
Where do we go from here? Where does the NCAA go? Where do players go? What is the fallout from this?
Well, I think the next step is going to be, we're going to see a number of lawsuits, a couple of which are already in the pipeline on name, image, and likeness, but you'll see it on athlete pay as well, athlete compensation. And I think the players will be successful. The NCAA will put the brakes on their name, image, and likeness legislation and do nothing because they will be afraid that anything they do will be too restrictive and therefore put them in jeopardy of further antitrust violations. They'll go to Congress on both knees and say, please bail us out of this horrible mess we've made for ourselves. As a serial antitrust violator, they will ask Congress for an antitrust exemption so they can continue to violate antitrust law with Congress's blessing. I don't think that'll be successful, but that's what they're going to try. And they're going to ask for a law that would limit what athletes can do and preempt all these differing state laws that they seem so afraid of. We're not long off now of players being allowed far more than a scholarship, whether it gets to being employees and being paid by the university. That may be a little bit further off, but they'll be doing commercials in no time and, you know, making real money for their name, image, and likeness. And not one fan is going to turn away because of it.
ESPN college basketball analyst Jay Billis speaking to ABC's Eric Mollo. We've heard it over and over again. It's been a violent spring, and it's gearing up to become an even more violent summer when it comes to gun crime. There are more guns than people in this country, 400 million of them. And police have told us they're having a very hard time keeping up. President Biden unveiling his strategy this week to try to stop it.
We have an opportunity to come together now as Democrats and Republicans, as fellow Americans, to fulfill the first responsibility of government on our democracy, to keep each other safe.
He signed executive actions in an attempt to cut off the flow of illegal gun purchases and has said that COVID relief money should be able to be used by cities to fund policing efforts. He's also called on Congress to do more. ABC senior White House correspondent Mary Bruce talked about the president's plan with Brad Milkey on the ABC News Daily Podcast. Start here.
Mary, I mean, not to be simplistic, but what can the president possibly do about gun violence that has not already been done?
Yeah, it's a good question, but the White House would argue and the president argues that there's plenty he can do, right? So this plan, which they bill as a comprehensive strategy to try and combat the spike in violence, but it's also really centered on gun reforms. But the overall plan is this. The president wants to crack down on gun dealers who break the law. They also want to redirect billions of dollars in COVID relief funding to help local police departments so that they can hire more officers and also invest in community intervention programs. So things like job training and assistance and things like that, that they hope will help get people off the streets and away from some of this crime.
Can you really just take money from a COVID relief bill and say, oh, now we're using it to solve the gun violence crisis? Is that allowed?
Well, they argue yes, because this is funding that went to state and local levels.
I think increasing our department staffing through these resources would be tremendously helpful.
And so now they're saying this is how that funding should be used, right? To help beef up police departments, make sure that they have the tools they need to better combat some of this crime.
When we talk about rising crime, it does seem like gun violence, crime in general, is something that's driving state and local political races. So have Republicans been successful in tying this uptick of violence to democratically elected leaders? Is this a political problem for the president?
Everything is political, right? And Republicans certainly are seizing on the rise in crime. They blame it on the movement to defund the police that grew out of all of the protests last year. And they really are using it as a cudgel. You know, I asked the White House specifically at the press briefing, the White House press secretary, why is Biden doing this now? You know, crime has been rising, as they point out, over the last several months, even years. Now, they don't really have a clear answer for that. They note that, you know, this is a policy process and that it took until now for some of these announcements to be ready to make.
The president would certainly like to see Congress act on universal background checks, on an assault weapons ban, a number of the pieces of legislation that are currently, I shouldn't say working their way through Congress, but are currently alive in Congress. But he's not going to wait.
But Biden has also been criticized for not using his political weight enough to act on gun reforms, for failing to use his bully pulpit in a way that many of Biden's supporters think is necessary. And it is possible that there is a certain political calculation here when they look at the fact that the president is getting some criticism from both sides. He's facing pressure. And as you are seeing crime go up, and they're anticipating that to continue as we head into those hot summer months.
Mary Bruce at the White House. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
As we slowly begin to ease out of the pandemic, there are some concerns about the cost of Well, just about everything. Food, rent, gas, houses. In fact, recent price increases have pushed the consumer price index to its highest point in more than 13 years, which is prompting fear that inflation could become a long-term issue. ABC's Elizabeth Schulze reports on how much more we're all paying for things as the economy reopens, and on the debate among policymakers on whether higher inflation is temporary or a sign of things to come.
Produce side of
Philip Samble is no stranger to the changing price of food.
It's on these signs. How often are you changing those numbers?
These are laminated, wipeable signs because we're changing them every single time we get a delivery.
He says lately at his small grocery store in Washington, D.C., most prices are going in one direction, up. The government's Consumer Price Index, or CPI, shows food prices increased 2.2% in May compared to a year before. Whole milk prices were up more than 3% in just 1 month. Fish and beef prices rose more than 2%.
Price of bacon, for example, have you had to change the number there in the past few months?
Yeah, that's definitely gone up.
It's not just food costs going up. The CPI data shows overall prices rose 5% in May from a year earlier, with gains in categories ranging from cars to apparel to appliances and equipment.
I can't think of a single building material that hasn't gone up.
Omar Karim is the CEO of a real estate and construction company.
For a sheet of plywood, 12 months ago, it was $34. Now you're talking about north of $80. Over 100% increase in 12 months, which is really unconscionable.
With American businesses and consumers now paying more money for goods and services, a debate is raging among economists and policymakers about if higher inflation is here to stay. Republican lawmakers say trillions of dollars in economic stimulus is supercharging consumer spending, leading to higher prices. It's a concern echoed by former Treasury Secretary under President Clinton, Larry Summers, who says the primary risk to the U.S. economy is overheating and inflation. But the current Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, along with Federal Reserve Chairman Jay Powell, insist the current run-up in prices is only temporary.
The incoming data are consistent with the view that the prices that are driving that higher inflation are from categories that are being directly affected by the recovery.
Powell says it's not surprising to see price hikes in industries like airlines or hotels that came to a standstill when the pandemic hit and are now bouncing back as vaccinations and travel ramp up.
We kind of went into panic mode.
Daphne Penn and her husband are moving from Peoria, Illinois to Philadelphia this summer and had planned a last-minute trip to visit apartments.
We got the flights, no issue. When we went to book a rental car, everything was sold out. We ended up having to cancel the trip.
She says moving costs are also rising.
I looked at an estimate for U-Haul U-Box, and I think it was going to be about $1,500 or $1,600. That's about maybe $400 more than what I had paid in the past.
From freight to rental cars to furniture, many industries haven't been able to keep up with pent-up demand. Backlogs in supply chains during the pandemic are another factor behind higher prices. A global shortage of computer chips has slowed down the production of new cars, leading used car and truck prices to spike nearly 30% in the past year. Many economists expect prices will drop after this year as economic stimulus starts to wear off, the economy fully reopens, and supply chains readjust.
We've seen really that people put the pedal to the metal. I mean, really gas it up over the last 12 months.
Omar Karim says after a surge in demand for construction and building materials over the past year, he's starting to see some prices drop.
There's just no way lumber or, you know, a piece of plywood can continue to increase. Projects ultimately will have to stop.
But there are signs higher inflation might not be temporary. One is that wages are going up. And if businesses or workers start to expect higher prices in the future, it can actually create more inflation. Philip Samble says consumers should be prepared to pay higher prices if it means raising workers' wages.
You see agricultural workers, delivery drivers, retail workers, all were underpaid before the pandemic. We're able in this moment to say we're essential.
ABC's Elizabeth Schulze. Coming up, 45,000 Foo Fighters fans at MSG. What it was like at that first post-pandemic full-capacity concert at Madison Square Garden. We'll have that on Perspective after this.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
From ABC News, this is Perspective, this week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, an Olympic athlete takes her battle with OCD public to help others, and an NFL player breaks barriers. But first, as COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations trend downward across the country, U.S. health officials have become increasingly worried about the highly contagious Delta variant, particularly in communities with low vaccination rates. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky telling Good Morning America this week that the Delta variant now accounts for more than 20% of all coronavirus cases in the U.S. But even that number could rise quickly.
Generally, when viruses mutate, they do so with some advantage to the virus. And in this case, the Delta variant, it is mutated so that the virus is more transmissible.
Now, meantime, at Madison Square Garden, it took 460 days, but it was open at 100% capacity last week for a Foo Fighters concert. It was the first time MSG filled all the seats for a concert since the pandemic began. Anyone who entered was required to be vaccinated, and one of those who entered was ABC's Matt Wolf. For as much as he enjoyed it, he says getting back into the swing of concerts post-COVID is a little weird. How many people does the Garden hold?
Well, Sherry, the Garden holds 20,000 plus people. And, you know, concerts are those communal experiences, you know, and when you're there and you're listening to the Foo Fighters and 20,000 plus people singing along with the band, boy, did it make you miss concerts. I'll tell you what.
So how did it work? Did you have to show proof of vaccination? Did you wear a mask? I mean, what was it like?
It was a strict protocol to show your vaccination card, some proof of vaccination. And I myself used an app. But, you know, it is sort of questionable. You look at the amount of people coming through, you have to think maybe one or two just got in. I tell you, you talk about weird. That's exactly it. We get in. The show starts. The woman next to me has a mask on. Everybody's starting to sing along to Times Like These. She just pulls that mask off and starts singing to the heavens. And I'm like, okay, what COVID? Off come the mask, everything. You know, next thing you know, it's as though the pandemic never happened. And I was back at Madison Square Garden, just where I was on March 11th at the Allman Brothers show, just 2 days before everything shut down. It was strange in that regard. And you know I'm always going out to concerts. We want that communal experience. I mean, you were at KISS a couple of weeks ago at Tribeca. How was that?
It was outside, though. They had Adirondack chairs set up in groups of two for people because there was a film, a documentary about KISS beforehand. And it was funny because before that, this small group of volunteers went around and said there can be no rushing of the stage. Well, first of all, KISS fans are a little older, but people didn't. They stood there and it was wide open. And again, Matt, it was outside. Inside with 20,000 people, I still think I would feel weird.
And I mean, you know, you've been to the Garden before. It's spacious. There ain't no 6 feet And we had seats, you know, sort of in the uppers there. And I'm looking down on the floor and I said, you know what? That's where I draw the line right now, because I don't want somebody, you know, literally on top of me. At least there's an armrest in between a little bit. And I think that's part of the post-COVID mentality is that, you know, even though hopefully the pandemic is winding down, you know, we're all a little bit more conscious now, I think, of how close this person is, or don't breathe on me over here, or watch where you're moving your beer there, buddy, you know, and you don't feel, you don't have to yell into my ear. I don't need that anymore. You know what I'm saying?
So give me the how you felt knowing that you were vaccinated and all those people that were in there. Was there any part of you who was kind of like, I feel a little weird, or, you know, afterwards? Well,
yes, you know, you do. I think it's human instinct. You know, you're looking around, like I said before, with 20,000 people, you're trying to tell me every single one of these here is truly 100% vaccinated. I don't know. The woman sitting next to me, turns out she was from Detroit. She flew in. She told me that, you know, in our city, the vaccination rate is at only 23%. And I jokingly said to her, I said, you got your vaccination card? And she pulled it out and showed it to me. I'm like, whoa, okay. You know, so I guess I'm safe here and my wife on the other side of me. But what about the people down in front? What about the person behind me? You just don't know. But I felt enough confidence, that sense of safety enough where I wanted to get back to a certain part of my life. And that's being entertained. Stan Lee once said that without entertainment, you'll go out of your mind. And Cherry, I don't know about you, but being cooped up in the house for over a year, we've made our sacrifices. We continue to make those sacrifices to start getting out there a little bit more now. But there's always that one side of you, you know, still thinking, what if? So proceed with caution is what I have to say.
That was ABC's Matt Wolf. For the first time in its history, last year, the mega-popular Eurovision Song Contest had to be canceled. The international competition, however, roared back to life this year with coronavirus bubbles added to its heady mix of music and camp. ABC News producer Joy Piazza reports on the immensely popular event's return this year and how it mixes high camp with lyrics to encourage inclusion and positivity while avoiding political messaging.
During Pride Month, there was a lot of emphasis on LGBTQ inclusion, representation, and acceptance. But ask fans of the Eurovision Song Contest about that, and they'll tell you those themes have been on display for years.
It was like our football world.
It was our Christmas.
Yeah.
It was like gay Christmas.
That's Asifa Lahore and her friend Claudia Lahore. Both are transgender women living in the UK. Asifa is known as her nation's first out Muslim drag queen. And for both of them, from the beginning, the Eurovision Song Contest has been their way of connecting with a larger world.
For me, it was like watching such diversity through music.
As my LGBTQ identity kind of manifested itself, Eurovision became my safe space.
The same can be said for Vasil Garvanliev, a contestant this year representing the Balkan nation of North Macedonia. He came out to the public shortly before the contest, becoming one of, if not the most, high-profile LGBTQ advocates in his country. But he says North Macedonia lags behind Western Europe when it comes to LGBTQ acceptance. Garvanliev says his coming out and a controversy surrounding Bulgarian imagery in the music video for his Eurovision entry led to backlash, xenophobic messages, even concerns for his safety.
I'm being advised by a lot of people because I love walking around. You have got to cut that out of your life.
Garvanliev says the artwork in the video was misunderstood and that there was no political subtext. He says his entry this year, Here I Stand, serves as an anthem for anyone trying to overcome adversity.
We all go through so much, and I said, this song is celebrating your journey. And you say, you know what, despite of everything that has happened, people will try to bring us down. We're not going to let them.
Eurovision has gained an American fan base in recent years, but the contest itself has been around for more than half a century. Martin Osterdahl, Eurovision's executive supervisor, explains.
And it came along in the 50s when the continent had been plagued by two devastating world wars. The objective was to, you know, we have to find other ways of understanding each other. It's actually been argued by a lot of academics that it's meant more for the definition of Europe than the European Union has done.
Eurovision has launched some artists into superstardom, like ABBA. The Swedish group won in 1974 with the hit Waterloo. In 1988, Celine Dion took the top prize representing Switzerland with Ne Parti Pas Sans Moi, English translation, Don't Leave Without Me. And in 2014, drag performer Conchita Wurst from Austria won, gaining international fame and helping to bring LGBTQ awareness to a larger audience with Rise Like a Phoenix. Eurovision is also known for its elaborate stage performances and out-there costumes. Encapsulated by 2006's winner representing Finland, metal band Lordi dressed like monsters or demons with platform shoes that rival anything Kiss would wear. The show itself is a massive undertaking. Tens of thousands of staffers, rehearsal time lasting for weeks. And then there's the voting. For the grand final, votes come in from a judges panel from each country and from some 200 million viewers. The results all tallied during the broadcast. But what makes the Eurovision experience truly unique? The sheer fact that performers of all different stripes come together to celebrate music in any form.
Ultimately, to celebrate what it's like to be human.
Gurvanliev says he felt it was his obligation as an artist to use his Eurovision song and performance as a platform for those who cannot speak up.
When I had the moment in there for they all tried to break us, not knowing it's what makes us. It's the moment where the back vocals sing, where I rip the shawl off and my body is this mirror shield that literally becomes, I kept saying, a lot of times when people attack us, we are the mirror to their sadness, pain, insecurities.
He says he's gotten a warm response from many who feel unsafe living as LGBTQ individuals.
A lot of people are creating fake profiles to write thanks to me. They say, I had to create a profile to say thank you for standing up because you're giving us a future.
Claudia remembers the moments when what she saw on the Eurovision stage helped her to realize her own truth. One moment, the winner in 1998, the Israeli entry, a transgender woman known as Dana International.
I knew I was different. I was told I was different. But it was only by seeing Dana International that I had the words that I too was a transgender woman. So I dare to say that Eurovision has been one of the founding blocks of my growth into the person that I am today.
And in the works, Americans will get a chance to participate in our own version. All 50 states and territories will duke it out in what's being billed as the American Song Contest. Asifa and Claudia say the contest isn't exclusively for the LGBTQ community, but they say it's played a crucial role in representation.
It's just a reflection of the time. I would not be surprised if in the next decade we have many more performers of color.
Vasil Garvanliev says he'll keep speaking out for LGBTQ rights and has this message for those who are struggling.
You go to sleep with a calm mind and a calm soul. And there's nothing more beautiful than that. Truth hurts, but once you give in to that, nobody can touch you.
Reporting for Perspective, Joy Piazza, ABC News, New York.
If you type in boxing and mental health on Google, you'll find articles that go in either one of two directions. Half of them have headlines like the one from Harper's Bazaar that reads, Six Ways Boxing Can Improve Your Mental Health. The other half have headlines like the one from Boxing News Online that read, Boxing needs to address its mental health problem. So which is it? Does punching a bag or another person help or hurt? For flyweight Ginny Fuchs, who's hoping to win a gold medal at the Olympics in Tokyo next month, it's a little of both. Ginny suffers from debilitating obsessive-compulsive disorder, and she says being at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs actually helps. She Zoomed with me from her hotel room. The first question I had for her, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. My main focus right now is obviously the Olympics and the fact that I finally qualified for the Olympics, and now all I have to focus on is, you know, getting prepared and winning the gold. So this focus of, you know, going to the Olympics, getting a gold medal has kind of helped not let me get stuck in my rituals and my certain behaviors.
Ginny's OCD is actually a common one, contamination. She has to constantly clean so as not to feel contaminated, obsessing over things like washing her hands, making sure her toothbrush is clean, and using disinfectant. She calls her disorder evil.
I never can just be at peace. I feel like I'm always, you know, my anxiety is pretty high a lot. With my lifestyle. And so that's how I see the evilness in it. So it doesn't let me be at peace a lot.
This is Sound of Ginny, by the way, training for the Olympics. And you might be wondering, how does a boxer of all athletes deal with an OCD, fear of contamination, when she's in the ring and training? The routine, she says, is what keeps her going.
Yeah, it's like a switch. Whatever the focus of the day of training is, I can just focus on that. Yeah, I might be like sparring or might be doing our abs on the floor and my hand might accidentally touch the ring for a minute. My mind might like obsess about it for a minute, but I'm able to like kind of block that off. It's when I leave the gym and I'm done with training is where my OCD becomes kind of like a beast.
Now, at first, she didn't want to talk about her OCD, but this year she is speaking up. Jenny has been taking part in Oprah Winfrey and Prince Harry's project on Apple TV, The Me You Can't See. She's also featured in a four-part documentary on PBS called Mysteries of Mental Illness. It's trying to bust the stigma and shame surrounding mental illness. Jenny's been to a lot of therapists and has found one she likes seeing in person, or at least she did, before COVID. Like a lot of patients, she says Zoom therapy is something, but it's not the same.
The cool thing is I'm in my home environment where I'm triggered to do these behaviors. So that's kind of cool. But the fact that she's not physically there with me makes the session a little not the same as if I was, you know, physically with her, because I can kind of cheat. She might not see me do something because it's just this screen.
So now, with a month to go before the Olympic Games in Tokyo, Jenny says she wants to get her story out there and let other athletes know they're not alone.
Don't be ashamed or embarrassed, because I used to be. I used to try to hide it. But when I kind of accepted it, I could understand myself better, and it made me happier with myself. Don't be ashamed to ask for help. Friends, family, teammates, coaches, it's okay to talk to them about it. And in the long run, that'll help you overcome it in small steps.
Jenny Fuchs says she would definitely be in the camp of people for whom boxing has helped. The ritual of training and keeping that goal of a gold medal in mind has helped keep her OCD at bay. She qualified for the Olympics last month, and you can watch her progress next month with the rest of Team USA in Tokyo. Another groundbreaker in the Olympics, New Zealand's Laurel Hubbard will become the first transgender athlete to compete in the Games. Some have argued that because she went through male puberty, she'll have an unfair advantage over her competitors. But she did meet the IOC's requirements for athletes who transition from male to female. Hubbard, who transitioned 8 years ago, said in a statement she was grateful to New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, who said publicly that Hubbard supported all the guidelines to earn her place at the Olympics. And finally, this decision was groundbreaking. Carl Nassib, the defensive lineman for the Las Vegas Raiders, posting on Instagram in a video announcing he's gay, becoming the first active NFL player ever to come out publicly.
I want to take a quick moment to say that I'm gay. I've been meaning to do this for a while now, but I finally feel comfortable enough to get it off my chest. I really have the best life. I got the best family, friends, and job a guy could ask for. I'm a pretty private person, so I hope you guys know that I'm really not doing this for attention. I just think that representation and visibility are so important.
Nassib also announced he'd be donating $100,000 to the Trevor Project, which provides crisis intervention and suicide prevention services to the LGBTQ+ community. Nassib received an outpouring of support from players and league executives, his jersey eventually becoming the top-selling item in the NFL. From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, you can subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you like and what you'd like to hear in the future. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcnewspodcasts.com. Perspective is produced by Eric Mollo. For ABC News, I'm Sherry Preston.